Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high and canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Fidelia. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey, and we couldn't do it without you. I say that every week, and it's true. What a marvelous installment and connection tonight, right on time. Couldn't be better. And Emily, go ahead and keep pushing. You know what she's doing, folks? She's pushing that almost full moon out of my sight. those folks that know me know that the full moon affects me. I don't think it's mental, but I could be wrong, but my worst marathon times were always on full moon days. And I never looked ahead to see that they were coming up. But anyway, it's passing by now, and welcome to spring, folks, and April Fool's Day. This isn't April Fool's. It is the Blog Talk Radio Show, and we're glad you're with us tonight. I think we have an interesting show. We're playing another video broadcast via audio tonight, and it's going to be very interesting because it's going to talk about the jihad next door. And this is Dina Temple Raston, who's written a book by that title. And we won't be able to play all of her interview that that appeared on Book Talk on C-SPAN just a while back. But I think you'll really enjoy this. And I'm going to make some connections and comments relative to the recent arrest of the less than a dozen folks up in Michigan that were arrested as part of this terrorist militia, apparently. And I've read every story about that I can get my hands on, and very interesting case, and I'll comment on that a little bit later. I'm thinking about doing some writing about that case, and it's pretty close, and I like to do that sometimes about sort of national affairs things that happen in my backyard. I did that with the Ice-T cop killer case once, and of course did it with the Minuteman closing the border in southern Arizona. I actually went there, so we'll see what happens. Johnny Cash, I want to thank you for singing that wonderful song, and yes, we promise some night, this is show number 177, I think, we will be singing that song, Audrey and Emily, and Mike and I, in unison, and we're going to go through all 92 cities and states that Johnny sings about in that song. So anyway, here we go. The purpose of our show is what it always is. We're discussing news, issues, events, and developments, the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. And boy, we got a couple of humorous ones tonight. At least I think they are. Wait till I tell you about the goldfish sting arrest. Really something. Our show is dedicated to those energetic and tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals at federal, state, and local level that protect us throughout the United States and even throughout the world. What we try to do in the show is look inside, criminal justice take a close-up look at its professionals as they perform their practice. You're listening on Blog Talk Radio. It just keeps getting bigger. I notice they keep throwing it. If you go to Blog Talk Radio site, just blogtalkradio.com, what you're going to see is there's a picture of Barack Obama, President Obama, right in the center. They're using a phone because he has figured out that he could use Blog Talk Radio too. And I think they're up to 29, maybe 30,000 shows a week. And Alan Levy's done that in about 3 years, where he started with one show with members of his family. Isn't that something that any human being, any interest group, any organization can have their own show free, can broadcast live and streaming audio worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners, and it doesn't cost you one penny? Isn't that absolutely something? Who would believe it several years ago that you could do something like that? And again, I say Alan Levy's the genius. He must be. He's got to be making some money from this, and I'm glad he is. But it doesn't cost us as a show producer and host anything to do. Well, we told you what the show is going to be about tonight. You can call in if you want during the news segment at 347-996-5983. That's 347-996-5983. And what we're allowed to do is hold four, five calls at the same time, and we'll see what happens. Audrey, you have a Ron joke for us tonight? I know this one. I read it ahead of time. I saw it in your notes. Sounds like a good one. Let's go ahead and hear Audrey's blog joke, ladies and gentlemen. And for those who might be listening for the first time, I do see that our listener thing does increase every week. It's something like 12,000. I'm not exactly sure what that is. But anyway, Audrey's got a joke tonight. Last week was about the driving manual. I think people enjoyed this one. This one's a cell phone joke. Go ahead, Audrey.
Professor Haley, tonight's blonde joke involves a blonde trying to comprehend technology, and as you can imagine, in this story she does not do that very well. I hope our audience enjoys it. Here it is. One day, a blonde decided to get a cell phone. After talking with the salesman, she finally selected a model and signed up for the service. Over the next few days, she called her friends and gave them her new number. A few days later, while shopping, her phone rang for the first time. Surprised, she answered it. It was her best friend. Completely dumbfounded, she asked in amazement, "How did you know where to call me?"
Oh, very good, Audrey. That one is a keeper. And ladies and gentlemen, on a much more serious note, the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms has actually developed a public service announcement that I'm sure they're appreciative that we play. And this is directed toward the criminals and the gangsters on the street. I know crime is low right now, but we still have gun toters out there that are using those guns for the worst kind of purposes. And we want them to hear this public service announcement so that they go down and turn in their firearms, and our streets will be safer. Go ahead, Ohio Coalition.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. Message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. It is a deadly idea, and we hope that we can reduce the carriage of those handguns on campus. Now, we're trying to do a green tip, and we're trying to save the planet. Somebody sent me an April Fool's news story today, and I fell for it, but said that two famous climate researchers, maybe some of you got it, two famous climate researchers down in the South Pole doing climate research, and they froze to death on their snowmobiles or sleds or whatever they were on. I'm so gullible when it comes to things like that. Anyway, this one is very interesting, and this one is from 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet, written by Esma Floyd, and this is a book that's directed toward small changes, creating a greener, eco-friendly world. And here's the first one. Did you ever think about this with life? Instead of filling multi-light fixtures with lower wattage bulbs, swap them for just one higher wattage bulb, or better still, swap your light fixture for one that uses a single bulb, which uses less electricity. I never think of doing that. That'd be a good idea. And related to that is tip number 397, and it says, use only what you need. Use electric light in your home according to the need rather than tradition. You probably don't need bright lights in every room. Often a desk light or bedside lamp will do just as well and use less wattage. Never thought about using a bedside lamp in my living room. That's a good idea. Try to do jobs that require more light during the daylight hours when the sun is strongest, leaving evening hours for relaxing. Now, that's a multifaceted tip right there. But, you know, I could add to that, you know, you've seen these little pen lights. You could probably turn out most of the lights in your house at night and just have one of these little pen lights and direct it, you know, in pen light fashion at the thing that you're trying to see, and you just be using that one little battery. But anyway, that's the tips tonight from Esma Floyd's 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. Let's go ahead and take a look at some of this criminal justice news. Some of it is off the page in terms of humor. I mean, you won't be able to believe some of these stories, and I'll get to them here just a minute as soon as it gets up. Thank you, Mike. It's up. Here's one that is really interesting, and this one has to do with a woman in Manchester, England, and I'm going to click up her story here and give you some information about it. This woman has owned and operated a pet shop for many years, and here's the story. The headline says that the pet shop owner is fined £1,000 and told to wear an electronic monitoring device, in other words, for selling a goldfish to a boy that was age 14. Her offense was to unwittingly sell a goldfish to a 14-year-old boy, taking part in a trading standard sting. So their council there in Manchester had actually sent out this 14-year-old boy to see if she would sell a goldfish to him. And the deal is that Joan Higgins did it. She's age 66, and you have to be in that city, according to the new animal welfare laws, probably coming from the United Nations, I mean from the EU, says that you have to be 16 years old to buy a goldfish, because you're thinking that someone under 16 would not know how to care for a goldfish. Harold just did a twist and a flip and went to the bottom of his tank here on my desk, but I don't know how much there is to know about dealing with a goldfish. Is there a lot? I think you sort of shake something in the water, change it once in a while, and that seems like that's it. But she said he looked 16 years or older, but she is now, she could have done some jail time, but she's given the fine, and she's now under a curfew that she's ordered to wear an electronic tag for 2 months. Now, can you absolutely believe that? Is that the height of government revelation? Regulation. I'm looking at a picture here of she and her son. He's 47 years old, Mark, and they just can't believe it, and the people in the town can't believe it. The name of her store is Major's Pet Store, but isn't that absolutely incredible that a woman would be caught up in something like that, and they would actually take her to jail? By the way, Belgium is going to be the first nation in Europe to outlaw the burqa. Isn't that kind of an interesting idea? They've taken this through their legislature. Their parliamentary committee agreed yesterday to outlaw the wearing of a face covering veils in public. The parliament will vote later this month. Now, they don't mention Muslims in Belgium, but they do have 650,000 of them. That's 6% of the Belgian population. And they're saying that the text of this law says that it's illegal to wear clothing that covers all or most of the face in any public place. And they're saying that this is necessary for it's a security risk for people walking around where you can't identify them if you should need to do that. I don't know what happened here in the United States, but I remember a few years back that some of the Muslim women actually had driver's licenses with them wearing the burqa, and all you could see was their eyes. Now, I guess if you use the driver's license in one fashion or another as a piece of identification, it would be difficult to tell who's under the burqa. But I think that is just incredible. Here's another story. I'm not going to read the details from it, but General McChrystal, who's in charge of our forces in the East, I think in Afghanistan and Iraq, at least with the understanding. He has taken Burger King and Pizza Hut and all the snack foods out of the soldiers' bases in those areas. And he actually made the comment, he says, first of all, they don't need these things, and then secondly, what would you rather have, ammunition for the mission that you're on that night or day, or, you know, junk food? And my answer to that would probably be, why can't we have both? I mean, GI's been doing that since the beginning of time. I can remember my calling out for my 14-cent fried rice in Okinawa numerous times, but he's going to eliminate that that junk food. And he's kind of a different person. He eats one meal a day. I guess that's the one bowl diet. You know, my book is the three bowl diet. But he has the one bowl diet, apparently, maybe a bigger one. And he runs 8 miles a day, and he sleeps 4 hours. So that's kind of a incredible set of features there for somebody to be running our forces overseas. Admirable in many ways, I'm sure. But isn't that something? Arizona is about ready to come forward. The governor's going to sign it. It's passed both houses of the legislature. They're going to be the first state in the nation that's going to make it a violation of state law for illegal immigrants to trespass on the state grounds. In other words, if you step on Arizona, the land in Arizona, and you're an illegal immigrant, you're violating state law. Therefore, that gives the law enforcement officers at any level in the state the right to enforce that law, and then you could be confined. And I assume the follow-up, this will be you know, call the Border Patrol and see if they're busy, and maybe the people will be sent back to Mexico. But that's the first state in the union is doing that, making a trespass violation, and that way they can't be hauling at them anymore about trying to, you know, enforce federal law when it's not their business. So that'll be interesting to see. We've probably read about the story of the militia up in Michigan. And I'm trying to find the right article. I've saved so many of them. Let me see here. Hold on. Don't leave. We do know that after 2-3 days that there was a government agent, an undercover FBI agent, with this group of people. And we'll start with this one. This is the most recent. But the 8 members of the extremist militia group accused of conspiring to kill law enforcement officers. And here was the deal, what they said. They said that this group and their leader, what they were going to do, Mr. Stone, they were going to kill a police officer in the area of Adrian, Michigan, Lawana, in Michigan anyway, but this Christian militia group was going to kill a cop. And then when cops came to the funeral, they said from like all over the nation, it would be awful if a cop would be killed, of course, but I doubt that cops are going to be coming from all over the nation. Then they were going to use missiles and explosive devices to kill all of those that would attend to the funeral. Now, that doesn't sound like a very sensible scheme. And B, we have to think about, I wonder whose mind this originated. I read the indictments. Those are packed tight up in one of the New York Times articles. You can click on it. You can read all the indictments. And then there are things like, a conspiracy to, or with the intent to, or the attempt, that type of thing. In other words, there wasn't any real result. Unfortunately, there wasn't. But there was an undercover agent. This didn't come out for a couple of days that there was an undercover agent working with him from the FBI. So you see the pictures of the group. They don't, you know, you can't always tell, but they don't look very very frightening. They might be a little off, a little short of a full load in terms of brain power, I'm saying. But the people around the neighborhood said they've been doing this for years. Yeah, they go out and shoot and run or do military operations and all that, which groups do all over the United States. And as long as you're not bothering anybody, there shouldn't be anything wrong with it. But the lawyer says in this that the prosecutors played a recording that was taped by a federal agent and infiltrated the group. It said Stone read from a speech that he prepared to deliver at a February meeting of militia groups in Kentucky. How much longer are you going to put up with a foreign army controlling your streets and your highways?
talking about, I guess, the police. He said, what we heard today is that Mr. Tone talks a lot, that Mr. Tone is angry. There's nothing that says he was looking to make war on the United States. This is his attorney. And he says all these people are going to have, you know, the issue here, I suppose, one of the issues will be entrapment versus encouragement to commit a crime. Government agents, police officers, are allowed to encourage people to commit a crime that they ordinarily would commit, but they can't entrap them. That would be making them commit a crime that they ordinarily would not commit. One of the rules of thumb of that, in whose mind did this crime originate? Now, what's interesting about this is I was listening to a radio show last night, and they had a retired government undercover agent on the radio show, and they were asking him questions about this incident and how he had worked things like this in the past. And one of the questions was, well, where were they going to get these missiles and these explosives? And you know what his answer was? The government would supply them. In other words, kind of, if you want these things, we've got these things, and then if you say you want them, and then boom, the arrest happens. Now, again, I'm not saying these are the sharpest people that ever came down the pike in this little militia group, but it's kind of interesting. I mean, if you have a right to be a little kooky and a little crazy in the United States, I suppose that's our right. Now, if this is a dangerous group that plotted on killing cops, what kind of people, it's not genius level, that would be thinking that cops would be coming from all the United States because one cop was shot in the area of Adrian, Michigan. And again, we don't want any cop shot, of course. We respect the noble duty that they perform, but this is an interesting case. There are many, many articles about it, and when you look at some of them, I passed one on today. When you look at one of the articles, you see what they had. The Michigan State Police had a tank. They had helicopters flying over in the air, and they had fixed-wing aircraft to make the arrest of these, I think, maybe just five or six of them on the first try. So they were certainly being safe. This is one we're going to hear a lot about here in the future, and it kind of relates to what we're thinking about here tonight in terms of the jihad next door. So we're going to turn to that, I think, and this is really a long tape, but I think we're going to use about a little less than 40 minutes of it, or audio, 40 minutes of it tonight. And Dina Temple-Russian is a good writer. I think this is like her fourth book. And we're going to crank this up here. It's going to take a minute here. We got to do some tricky electronic stuff, so don't run away. Hold on.
Dina Temple-Raston explores America's first sleeper cell, the Lackawanna Six, who were Muslim American men accused of training in a terrorist camp in Afghanistan. This is about an hour.
And I'm actually touched by all the people who came out and promised they would, so I appreciate that very much. All my brothers and sisters and family members. I wanted to start by doing a little bit of audience participation. And that is, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. If you can raise your hand where you are on them, that'd be great. The first is, how many of you have heard of the Lackawanna Six? Okay. That's about what my experience has been in the people I talk to generally. The second is, how many of you think that they were America's first homegrown Al-Qaeda sleeper cell? Okay. So, unclear. That's fine. How many of you thought that they'd been railroaded and weren't a danger to America and were just being called a sleeper cell for maybe political motivation? Okay. A couple. Okay. My experiment still works. And the reason why it still works is because everybody's heard of the Lackawanna Six, and no one quite seems to know what the story was with them, whether they actually were a threat to America, whether they actually were a sleeper cell, or whether they were railroaded. And there's a reason for that confusion. And the reason is that the story is very nuanced and fairly complicated, and it was very hard to get that nuance and that complicated story out in the newspaper articles that you were reading. So you ended up getting a real shorthand. And what the book's trying to do is to fix and remedy that problem, sort of set in stone once and for all what it was the Lackawanna Six were about, and whether or not homegrown terrorism is something that you really do need to worry about, and also about the radicalization of young Muslim men, which I think is something increasingly we're starting to worry about as we hear more and more of these plots coming out from Fort Dix to the JFK plotters and a number of others that have come out in succession. And those plots, it seems that there's always sort of two views as well, which is either these are very scary people, or, again, like the Lackawanna Six, these are people that somehow weren't planning anything, but we have jumpy law enforcement that did something to clamp down on them. So in that way, the Lackawanna Six is incredibly instructive in how homegrown terrorism happens and how young men might be radicalized and how, in the end, we as Americans and we as law enforcement and we as citizens just generally could maybe help derail this whole problem of homegrown terrorism. I mean, clearly it's a bigger problem in Europe now, but that doesn't mean it's not going to happen here. So I'll start out by giving you the basic narrative. So you have the building blocks for the Lackawanna Six are about. Fact one, the Lackawanna Six did go to an Al-Qaeda camp. No question about that. And that looks bad for them. But they went before 9/11. And for me, as someone who's researching this book for 3 years, there's a very bright line between people who go to these camps before 9/11 and people who go afterwards. You're in Washington, so we're fairly informed. But if you think of 6-20-somethings in Lackawanna who are not devourers of the New York Times or the Washington Post and don't pay a lot of attention to the news around them, it's possible that they didn't fully understand what they were getting into. Also, you have to recall that there are six of them, and we talk about them as a group all the time. The Lackawanna Six is that they're one. And in fact, there are gradations in the Lackawanna Six, and there are some that are worse than others. And those gradations really got lost in the coverage. And so in some of the coverage, for example, in the Buffalo News, they said they all knew about the 9/11 attacks and didn't tell the authorities. Well, that's not exactly true, as you'll learn as I proceed with this talk. But they knew something was going on. And there's a cultural reason, I think, for why they didn't tell the authorities what they knew when they came back from the camp. But again, I'll get into this a little bit later. I'll read a little bit of the book to you so you have an idea of what it reads like. It's the idea in narrative nonfiction, this is my fourth book, is to make it fun to read so you don't realize you're learning a lot in the process. And hopefully. And the other part that's important is that I try to keep myself out of it as much as I can. I actually do try to write very objective books so that you are presented with both sides of the story. And by the time you get to the end, I may have plotted you in a particular direction, but essentially you're making up your own mind based on the facts, just as you would with good journalism. And that's what I'm trying to practice when I write these nonfiction books. So I'm starting out where the young men have already left Lackawanna, and they already are in the camp, and they've had their first couple of days in the camp, and they're not enjoying it. And I should say that the Lackawanna Six were not choir boys, and it's very important to understand that. They were young, and they were naive, but they were also guys who did a lot of cigarette smuggling across the Canadian border. They were into drugs, not heavy drugs, but they were into drugs. One in particular, Yassin Taher, his brothers were in and out of jail constantly with heavy drug dealing and were kind of bad guys. Compared to them, Yassin was actually a choir boy because he hadn't been in jail until this happened. He was voted friendliest in his high school class. He was captain of the soccer team. He dated the head cheerleader and eventually married her. She was a white girl. He converted to Islam for him. So there are a lot of gradations here. And then there's a gentleman named Yahya Gobba, who was much harder or Jabir El-Banna, also one of the six, who never came back and is not at large in Yemen, but basically is in a very odd, almost catch-and-release program with the Yemen authorities. The Yemen authorities grab him, put him in jail, and then they ask for the $4 million or $5 million reward for him, and then they can't decide how to split it if the Americans give it to him, and then he gets released. And then they catch him again, and they put him in. So the FBI, that's a little bit about Yemen, yes, but I'm the FBI correspondent for National Public Radio. So the FBI say that Jabir El-Banna is on a catch-and-release program with the Yemen government. So it's a nice way to hear them talk about it, I think. So let me go ahead and read. They are now in the camp, and they're quite frightened, and they don't know exactly how they got here. It was all very exciting to make this trip to the camp. And I should also add that I was a little bit nutty, and I decided that I was actually going to follow directly in their footsteps from Yemen, Pakistan, through the jihadi hotels across the border of Afghanistan, right to the brink of where the camp was. And you know those videos of the guys on the monkey bars and with the hoods on and running through the tires? That's where I went. And it's no longer there. It's kind of a big hole now, actually, and bent monkey bars. It's been bombed, and it's out in the dunes. But I thought in order to have any sort of street credibility at all for this book, that I needed to experience what they experienced, at least in some way. And I went after they did. But I have to tell you, I've been a foreign correspondent for quite some time, and wearing a burqa and being in the back of a car and sort of sneaking around and doing very much the same things that they did, I got swept up in the adventure of it too. And what that gave me an understanding of is just how much they must have been. And this is an excuse that they made when they came back, that they were pulled by the undertow of this idea of being a jihadist. And they didn't quite, they sort of were swimming with the undertow, and they suddenly realized they were in way over their heads. And as someone who did something very similar, I didn't become a jihadist, but I certainly followed in their footsteps. There were dumb things I did, particularly in Afghanistan, that were just plain stupid, that would have gotten me killed, but I got swept up in the whole idea of it. And that gave me a sort of insight to what they must have experienced. I don't think if I hadn't gone, I don't think I would have that insight or that understanding, that empathy with what they might have experienced. So, let me read. The sun was setting on the camp when the trainers began gathering guns, disarming sentries, and tugging Kalashnikovs from the hands of recruits who were reluctant to give them up. They instructed their charges to cover their faces. They were going to be camera filming, they said. All we want to see is your eyes. Then out of the desert, trailing sand and dust behind them, three four-wheel drive Land Cruisers and four-door pickups raced up to the camp. Trainers in the hills and on the rooftop of the mosque began firing their weapons in the air as a celebratory greeting. Rocket-propelled grenades flew skyward. For many minutes, the noise of the ammunition was deafening. The Lackawanna boys suppressed the urge to take cover and crane their necks to see who had arrived. The guards emerged first. Armed to the teeth, they fanned out around the vehicle. On top of their shalwar chemise, they wore camouflage vests. Their faces were covered, but what caught the eye of the Lackawanna six was the weaponry they carried. There were Kalashnikovs and rocket-propelled grenades, and there were long magazines of bullets and handguns. Bin Laden, Alwan whispered under his breath. Alwan is one of the Lackawanna six. Then the sheep emerged. Bin Laden is protected by concentric circles of security. There's an outer ring of loyal villagers, a second ring of tribal leaders, and an inner ring of personal aides and bodyguards. This is the last group that emerged from the vehicles that afternoon. Bin Laden's bodyguards, officials say, are thought to include as many as five of his sons. It is said they would rather martyr their father than allow him to be taken alive. Alwan, recalling seeing one particularly tall guard, assumes he was a Bin Laden. Osama Bin Laden swung out of the car, bending almost double to squeeze his frame out of the small door opening. He was trailed by Alman al-Zahiri, the man who emerges as second in command. He had fought, like Bin Laden, in the Afghan resistance against the Soviet Union in the 1980s. The Lackawanna six had never heard of him, and didn't recognize him, but the way he moved around Bin Laden suggested that he was someone important. What Rasim Tahir, again, one of the Lackawanna Six, didn't understand. So Bin Laden starts talking to them in the mosque, and he's speaking Arabic, and most of the Lackawanna Six don't speak Arabic, which is problematic if you're in a camp where everyone speaks Arabic. So a lot of the sort of training that they had in the early days was all in Arabic, and they didn't understand it, and then they finally got them a training manual that was in English, and they really enjoyed it much more once they understood what was going on. I shouldn't joke about this, but it was definitely a handicap that they had while they were there. So Bin Laden starts speaking to all these people in Arabic, and a few spoke English, so they would sort of translate back to the Lackawanna Six who didn't speak Arabic. And while Yasin Tahir didn't understand everything that Bin Laden said, he recalled later that Bin Laden was thinking that there were 40 men prepared to, quote, take their souls in their hands, end quote, to carry out suicide bombing missions against the United States and Israel. Tahir swallowed hard and exchanged glances with his friends. Alwan, in particular, looked shocked. The men were told to remain in the mosque while Osama bin Laden departed. He and his entourage left Al-Farouk camp through the back gate, disappearing in their Toyota cave over the hill and into the desert. The Lackawanna Six were part of a small handful of Americans who had ever seen bin Laden in person, and those meetings would come to haunt them. So now I've just debunked another one of the myths, or proven true one of the myths about the Lackawanna Six. They did, in fact, meet bin Laden. In fact, they met him twice. Something that came up in their plea agreement that they must have known what was going on if they actually sat down with bin Laden and didn't come to the authorities and tell them what they knew, which was particularly upsetting the authorities. So one of my favorite parts of the book, actually, is about 9/11. And originally, when I started the book, I started it with 9/11, and my editor said, everybody starts with 9/11, you don't get to. So I had to start with something else. And so 9/11 actually occurs quite late in the book. And the reason why it's stirring is because a lot of the news reports in Buffalo News started out by talking about how they knew that 9/11 was going to happen, and they didn't tell anybody. And in fact, they didn't. What they knew is that there was going to be some sort of attack at some point. They didn't know if it was actually going to be in the States. They didn't know the timing of it. All they knew were rumors in the camp and what Osama bin Laden had said rather obliquely in this particular mosque meeting. So much was made of this that they could have stopped 9/11. So I'm debunking this myth. They could not have stopped 9/11. And here is where the cultural thing comes in. I think most of us, if we had gone to a camp before 9/11 and decided that we had made a mistake, would have come back and thought about how we might be able to make amends from that. And in our toolbox, there would be the possibility that we would actually go to law enforcement and say, I did something really stupid. I went to this camp, and this is what I know. And this is what I saw, and this is what I said, and sort of throw ourselves on the mercy of the goodwill of law enforcement. Most of us as law-abiding citizens would think that would be the natural thing to do. Wouldn't be the first thing maybe we did, but eventually maybe we would get to that. Okay. For the Lackawanna Six and these young men in Lackawanna, they weren't alienated like what we hear about Muslims in Europe today. But they were separated. They lived in a Yemeni enclave in the first ward of Buffalo, or of Lackawanna, just outside of Buffalo. And they weren't part of the community in a way that we would naturally be. They also didn't have a tremendous amount of belief in law enforcement there. In fact, they didn't trust. Anytime the police came around, it was always going to be trouble. So in their toolbox, I don't think it ever occurred to them that the best thing to do to get out of this trouble was to go and talk to law enforcement. And in fact, this is something that came up again and again and again during the plea agreement. Why didn't you come and talk to us? If you'd come to talk to us, then we could have helped you. At the time, while they were still at the camp, an FBI agent, who's one of the main characters in the book, named Ed Needham, who is sort of straight out of Central Casting. I almost didn't pick him as the main character because he was so perfect, people would think I'd made him up. He's a really, really sort of salt-of-the-earth, takes in stray dogs, helps foster children, that kind of guy. And I'm not, and I don't mock that in the least. I mean, he just really is a straight up, really good guy. He used to be a social worker, and then sort of happened to go into law enforcement. So this is the way I think he actually pursues his investigation from the FBI. He's actually a very understanding guy. And he got an anonymous letter in June of 2001 that, from somebody in the Lackawanna community who said, I'm very worried and I'm scared for my life. There are a group of young men from Lackawanna who have gone to a training camp in Al-Qaeda to become jihadists. And I think you should know. So clearly this is somebody in the Lackawanna community who had the one tool in the toolbox that I say the other six didn't have. And so Ed Needham opens his letter, and it's sort of typed out, and it's not signed. But there was enough specificity in it that he could go and check out what it was. And as he started checking out the names, he started to get increasingly more worried. So he put them on a watch list. So when they came back to the United States, the FBI already knew where they had been. And occasionally they would make a phone call to one of the six and have them come out to the office and say, what were you doing when you were gone? And they said, we were in Pakistan. We were with this religious group. We were learning more about our culture. And they never, ever mentioned Afghanistan. That was their big mistake. If they finally fessed up before they had them dead to rights, the outcome would have been fairly different, I guess. So I was telling you that one of my favorite parts of the book is the section where I report on the reactions to 9/11. And the reason why is because their reactions to 9/11 were sort of our reactions but heightened. Because remember, they had clues coming in. Something bad was going to happen. They didn't know where. They didn't know when. They didn't know how. All they knew is they'd been to a camp. They came back. They tried to lay low and resume rather aimless, lower middle class lives. And then all of a sudden, they turn on the TV, and Taher is with his wife, Nicole, and his son, Noah, who was about 2 at the time. And a neighbor, you know, in Lackawanna, it was the same beautiful day that we had in New York. That was my first day at CNN. I moved to New York on September 9, unpacked on the 10th, and then my first day at CNN was 9/11. So maybe it's my fault. So someone, they had a beautiful day in Lackawanna that day. You know, it was a bluebird day in New York where all the windows were open, one of those great Indian summer days. And a neighbor next door says to them as they're sort of rolling around in bed, go turn on the TV, turn on the TV. So Yassine turns on the TV, and he looks, and he sees that a plane is going into the tower. And they're actually watching when the second plane goes in, as many of us did. Yassine gets up and lowers all the blinds and shuts them. And Nicole, who still doesn't know he's gone to an Al-Qaeda camp, because he never told her, and his wife, turns and says, what are you doing? And she then lies on the carpet and curls up in fetal position and says, for Muslims, everything is lost. So imagine how much, and I'm not feeling sorry for him, but I'm just saying, imagine what it would have been like to have a hint that something like this was going to happen, and then have it happen. And Nicole, of course, didn't understand what he's talking about because she thought he'd gone to Pakistan to get, you know, some sort of religious education. And Nicole says, don't be ridiculous. And she's pulling up the blinds and says, get up, stop being ridiculous. And then they sat and watched television for the rest of the morning. Fahim Alwan called Ed Needham. I said, I'm really sorry about this. Everybody's really upset about this. Let me know if there's anything I can do to help. And Ed Needham said, if someone new comes to Lackawanna, you need to let me know. That's what we're worried about now. And remember, Ed Needham's pretty sure they did something they weren't supposed to do, but he still doesn't know completely the extent to which they had gone to the camp and whether they had signed on to this whole jihadist idea. And I don't want to ruin the whole book for you, but let's just say that someone new did come to town, and they didn't tell them. They didn't tell the authorities, and it became a real problem for them when they actually started trying to plead for some sort of leniency. what the book is trying to do is several things. It's not just telling the story of the Lackawanna Six. And the Lackawanna Six is a great story, and I'm stunned that no one did it before I did, particularly somebody in Buffalo who was right there on the ground and understood the culture better than I did. I had to sort of move in there. I consider myself a Buffalonian now because I lived through last winter in Buffalo, which we had 9 feet of snow in 2 weeks. And I would call my boyfriend and say, "You won't believe it, snowing again." And still used to sort of have this magical quality for me. All gone now. There's no magic left in snow. Nothing against Buffalo. There's just too much of it. And I was there with a small, lonely sheepdog puppy. And all I had between freezing to death was a small space heater, a sheepdog puppy, and I thought of an electric blanket, which I thought was just a great mind thrust that I thought of buying an electric blanket. I used to get ice on the inside of my window. So I feel that I've gone through a lot of the hardships that people who live in Buffalo go through, and I can understand, I empathize with them. What the book's trying to do is a couple of different things. One is just being the story of the Lackawanna Six. I'm using them as a vehicle to take a look at homegrown terrorism more generally in this country and, you could say, in Europe as well. In that sense, this is the first book that actually looks step-by-step at how normal people get radicalized. These are fairly normal, soft-law kids, not particularly bad, not particularly good. And I shouldn't call them kids, they were in their 20s, but they were not responsible 20-year-olds. They were frivolous 20-year-olds, is the nice way to put it. They didn't have jobs for the most part. They didn't really care about getting jobs. They drank, they smoked, they did some petty crime, so they were hardly sort of stand-up citizens. On one level, it's the justice that was meted out for them that I think is very interesting. If you go to an al-Qaeda camp, even if you go before 9/11, I think most people will probably agree at some level you're probably going to have to go to prison for that. And I'm not sure I like the way they ended up going to prison or how the media covered that event. But in general, I think most people would agree that we feel okay that they went through the justice process and justice happened. The man who came to Lackawanna that I was referring to earlier, the newcomer that no one knew about, was a man named Juma El-Dosri. And Juma El-Dosri was an imam from Indiana. And he was accused of being the so-called closer, the guy who came back and said to the Lackawanna Six, "You guys will never be good Muslims unless you do jihad. You have to go to camp." So he was sort of like a doctor giving you a second opinion. And weeks later, they prepared him well. So he was, in a very real way, the closer. He was found on the border of Pakistan shortly after the U.S. government or the U.S. Army invaded Afghanistan. He was turned over by the Pakistanis, and it was said that he was an al-Qaeda member. So we know where he went. He went to Guantanamo. And he was there for 5 years. And I don't know how many people have seen Road to Guantanamo, that movie, but there's a very, very stirring scene there where someone gets beaten to a pulp. That person who got beaten to a pulp, and it's documented, was Juma El-Dosri. And he was eventually, and the FBI actually went down there and checked it out, and a lot of things changed after Juma's beating was actually documented. The FBI was actually quite upset about what happened, what was going on down there. Juma was let out in July. He was one of the worst of the worst, yet he was freed and sent to Saudi Arabia in July. Now, and most people say after that, they say, well, of course, then the Saudis put him in jail. No, actually, the Saudis flew his parents in to Riyadh so that they could have a family reunion and he's free. He was the worst of the worst, and yet he's free. Do we feel okay about that? That he was never charged with anything, that in the kind of rap sheet that they used in Guantanamo, Lackawanna was never mentioned. Instead, he was in there for being present at Tora Bora. Maybe in this age of terror, we feel comfortable with that and we can't take any chances. But the idea of the book is to make you wonder whether you feel comfortable with that. Finally, there's a last level of justice that the book sort of looks at, and that is the story of Kamel Derwish, who was a Lackawanna guy who had moved to Saudi Arabia and came back and was the al-Qaeda recruiter. Absolutely al-Qaeda everybody says he's Al-Qaeda, there's really no doubting that. And he brought these guys, plus 10 more, who were ready to go after them, from Lackawanna to the camp in Afghanistan. He never came back. They were hoping he would. He never came back to the United States. And instead, he was in a convoy driving across the Yemeni desert and was summarily assassinated by a U.S. Predator missile, which the U.S. still does not officially admit to. He was an American citizen. Are we okay with that kind of stuff? Or maybe have we stepped a little bit further than we feel comfortable with and we need to start walking it back? That's the larger question that the book is asking. What we're doing by being a little heavy-handed. And it's not critical of the government. Instead, what it's offering is, here's what we're doing, and here's how it's affected these particular men. How do you feel comfortable about these decisions that we've made about justice? And at what point do we sort of draw a line about what we stand for? And at the risk of sounding incredibly patriotic, I think that we're supposed to hold ourselves to a higher standard. And for all the arguments I've had with people over the war on terror, I think in the end, everyone agrees that what America is about is holding ourselves to a higher standard. And I'm not entirely sure in this story that we held ourselves to the standard that we should be holding ourselves. But that's a decision that you're supposed to make when you read the book. So I'll leave it at that, and I'd be happy to answer some questions if you have them.
What was the sentence for the last one?
Varying sentences. The easiest way to say 7 to 9 years. Right now, they're in a very interesting prison in Terre Haute, Indiana. Originally, they were promised in their plea agreement that they would be close enough to Lackawanna for their families to visit them. And then there was a decision made, I guess, last year that they wanted all these Arab jihadist prisoners in the same prison. So they put him in a prison in Terre Haute, Indiana, which is, now I'm trying to remember the name of what they call it, but basically it's a special communication prison so they can monitor all their communications. So rather ironically, the Lackawanna 6, who were all separated before, are now all together in the same cell unit and talk to each other all the time. I guess I sort of have a problem with that. I don't think that's such a great idea. Listen.
Were you able to speak with them after they were in prison?
No, they...
Did they report along the way?
Without divulging too much about how I know what I know, I saw a lot of things that you're not supposed to be able to see that were statements and transcripts of what they actually said. So a lot of what's in the book, I could not get permission to talk to any of them. I talked to their families extensively. I talked to people in the neighborhood extensively. The FBI actually was incredibly helpful. Their lawyers were incredibly helpful. But there's something called, well, no, I'm not going to say that. There are some documents that exist in which they're transcripts of what they actually said and admitted. And it's in their own words. So in a way, it's better than interviewing them now, because I got interviews that were essentially real time. So they didn't have time to sort of change their stories. I got their original stories.
I'm just curious about whether you got a sense of their perspectives after all this, you know, happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, and that's in the book. Mostly from family members who until they were moved to Terre Haute, were visiting them all the time. Fahim Alwan, one of them in particular, the older one who was more responsible, who made like this last-minute decision to go. Crazy. And he's fairly articulate. Feels so bad about what he did. He's absolutely fine with the sentence, doesn't complain. He thinks he should have gotten more. I mean, he's got that sort of attitude. Yassin Taher apparently hasn't changed a bit. The guy who voted friendliest of his high school class, still happy-go-lucky even though he's in prison. So, you know, I don't know how Goba exactly, who's sort of an older, truer believer in what was going on in the camp, how he reacted, although I know he's been a witness, sometimes accidentally identified in a number of the terrorism cases, including the deal. Yes. How confident are you about their version of what happened in Afghanistan you know, their version of saying that they got nervous when they started to hear about what Bin Laden was up to, what these people were up to. Well, all six versions of these documents that I can't name actually track each other fairly well. And, you know, it could be hindsight that they came back and said, gee, we were really scared. But at the same time, two of them actually faked injuries to leave early. And these are the ones that I sort of depend on in talking about how frightened they were in the camp. Because if you actually take an injury to leave early, one would naturally assume you weren't happy while you were there and you were scared. They also came back and wouldn't talk about it at all. Now, there are several of them that did blab about this to in-laws even, and not all that smart, who didn't have that same fear. But certainly the ones who left early were very frightened by it. And I think when they came back, they were a little freaked out. And certainly after 9/11, they were very freaked out. I think they didn't realize that they were part of it. Yes, sir.
Could you speak up just a little bit to C-Stan and want to hear your every word? A question related to the book. Do you have any sense about how intense of a recruiting effort there might be in this country to get other Americans to go to C-Stan?
I think the book, no. I mean, it's not that hard to recruit people. And I think that when you read the book, you'll see that there's actually a process they go through in doing that, and it's not very hard to do. I think we're hearing now a lot about the Europeans that are going to camp in Pakistan now, but I actually think this whole camp thing is a little passe for Al-Qaeda. I think that Al-Qaeda now feels that the internet and there are other ways to train people much more efficiently that can't be bombed and can't be found. And so I think they're morphing out into much more of these hunger and terrorists that don't have terrific training and maybe know how to put together a bomb, or maybe there's one guy who knows how to put it together and gets a group of guys who are willing to put their souls in Allah's hands, and that's all they need. You don't have to be all that smart to be a terrorist. You just have to be lucky. And a lot of these plots have been foiled, particularly in Europe, the sort of bigger, heavier ones. Frankly, they were unlucky, and that's why they were foiled. They got the European authorities were given tips in large part by Muslims who were there.
She goes on to say that she's predicting we're going to see some of these single bomber, single incidents, or more of those here in the United States, and that portends trouble for us for sure. But again, I think people need to recall overall that, you know, terrorism is the politics of the weak. If they were strong, they wouldn't need to do that. So it's certainly going to represent a challenge for us. And I think the comparison and contrasting of the Lackawanna group with the group up here in around Adrian, Michigan, is kind of interesting in terms of perspective and the undercover agents and the threats, ones on, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what happens in that that case up there. Well, that's it. That's it for tonight, folks. We're glad that you joined us. Check our billing on the show for next week, and I'm sure that we'll be meeting again.
Singing this song, we again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.